Tonight I want to speak to you on the subject, holding up or folding up. Running is fast becoming an American addiction. Wherever I go, they're pounding the pavement. And frankly, while most people find jogging appealing, I find it repelling. In fact, every time I get the urge, I lie down and it goes away. But I must confess, there is one form of running to which I am magnetically and irresistibly drawn. That's the marathon. The reason? No, I don't plan to take it up at my superannuated stage of life. But I believe it is the best analogy of the Christian life. You've all heard of the four spiritual laws, but have you heard of the 14 spiritual flaws? One of the greatest of which is, the Christian life is a dream, when in reality, it's a discipline. To become a Christian means you've got a blast ahead of you. The truth is, you've got a battle ahead of you. There's a war on, and the bullets are real, and the casualties are high. The great danger of embracing the idiocy that the Christian life is a piece of cake. The truth is, it's a grueling marathon. It's not a 100-yard dash. It's a long-distance run, 26 miles, 385 yards. And success in this race is not determined primarily by how you begin, but by how you finish. Not by your entrance, but by your endurance. That's why Paul could say at the end of his life in ministry, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. Who of us will ever forget the exhausted Swiss runner this past summer at the Olympics? Gabriella Anderson Scheiss, whose legs became like rubber, and who staggered around the track as if drunk, only to finish the Olympic marathon and collapse in the hands of her friend. Analysts were quick to inform us of the explanation. She had hit the wall. And anyone who has done long-distance running is familiar with the wall. Oh, it will differ with every individual, but at some point in the race, the person comes to the place where it's as if they were hitting a concrete wall. They are convinced they could not run another inch. All of their resources have been exhausted. Physically, all of the blood sugar of their muscles has been used up and their body is dehydrated. If you've experienced it, you will never forget it. The dizziness, the fainting, the muscle paralysis, sometimes the complete collapse. And ladies and gentlemen, the same is true in the spiritual race. Just ask some mature man or woman of God. Many times in the course of their Christian experience, they will tell you, they hit the wall. Convinced that the odds were overwhelming, that their resources were totally exhausted and nothing else was available. They couldn't go on. May I remind you that Jesus Christ hit the wall on at least two different occasions in his life as a model man. In John chapter 12 and verse 27, there is a profound insight into our Savior's life on earth. Jesus said, "Now my heart is troubled." That's an intriguing word. It means to be thrown into mental confusion, to be agitated. "And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour?" No. "It was for this very reason I came to this hour." Do you sense the tug of war going on in his heart? He's drawn toward the cross because that's the purpose for which he came. But humanly, he moves away from the cross. He wants to be involved in it and he wants to avoid it. He's 33 years of age, at the peak of life, and he doesn't want to die. Greatest part of life ahead of him. In Mark chapter 14, in the Garden of Gethsemane, at verse 33, we read that Jesus began to be deeply distressed and troubled. Same word. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." He's facing the ordeal by himself, and he's numb. He's stunned by the prospect. Going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that, if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Do it another way." "I can't go past the wall." The Apostle Paul hit the wall on many occasions. In fact, if you want a good personal study in this area, I would suggest you study the book of 2 Corinthians. It's the book of service, of ministry. That's why you have such a concentrated emphasis on the person and work of Satan. Satan attacks your service. And in the book of 2 Corinthians, chapter 1 and verse 8, Paul says, "We do not want you to be misinformed, brothers." The scriptures never approach life from an idealistic point of view. They always come at it with a realistic perspective. "We don't want you to be uninformed about the hardships we suffered in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life. We were convinced this was it. We couldn't go beyond the wall." Look at chapter 6 and verse 4. You have a Bible in front of you. "Rather, as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way, in great endurance," key word in the New Testament, "in troubles, hardships, and distresses, and beatings, imprisonments, and riots, in hard work, sleepless nights, and hunger." Verse 9, "known yet regarded as unknown, dying yet we live on, beaten and yet not killed, sorrowful yet always rejoicing, poor yet making many rich, having nothing and yet possessing everything." Every mature Christian immediately resonates with the truth of those verses. The paradox of spiritual service. Look at chapter 7 and verse 5. For when we came into Macedonia, this body of ours had no rest. He wasn't taking coffee breaks. He wasn't going off on a vacation. But we were harassed at every turn. I love to paraphrase this. We were surrounded by spiritual Excedrin headaches. Conflicts on the outside. Fears within. You see, my friends, we have such a fakey idea of what the Christian life is, and particularly how the Apostle Paul lived it. We sort of think of him as some bionic believer who had it all wired together, sort of sailed through life with no difficulty. These verses give the lie to that. And don't let anybody brainwash you that the Christian life is a piece of cake. Turn over to chapter 11. Verse 23. Are they servants of Christ? I'm more. I've worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in dangers from my own countrymen, in dangers from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger in sea, and in danger from false brothers. My friend, that's living dangerously. I've known hunger. I've labored. I've toiled. I've gone without sleep. I've known hunger and thirst, and have often gone without food. I've been cold and naked, and besides every pressure, my concern for all of the churches. Probably the greatest frustration in the apostles' life. The Apostle Paul had been to the wall, but he learned the secret of how to go beyond it. And that's what I want to share with you tonight from his experience. If you have a Bible or a New Testament, will you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9? 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24. And if you've got a little pen or a pencil, I want you to write something in your Bible. Just 3 little words that'll bring you back to this passage over and over again. Here's the secret of getting beyond the wall. It's stated in verse 24. It is illustrated in verse 25. And it is applied in verses 26. And 27. Let's look at it. It's stated in verse 24. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Now, in the immediately preceding context, the Apostle Paul has set forth his philosophy, his lifestyle of ministry. He said, I become all things to all men that by all means I might win some. That's a staggering commitment. And now he wants you to know that when you make a decision, your decision will demand some discipline. Service of that kind always involves sacrifice. You make a commitment, but there is a cost. You want the privilege of ministry? There is no greater. Make sure you understand the price tag. You see, the Apostle Paul was willing to give up his rights in order to fulfill his responsibility. In fact, if you look in the immediately preceding verses, you will discover he gave up at least 3 of them. He gave up the right of eating meat offered to idols. For your information, the best meat in the community. He gave up the right to marry a wife. He gave up the right to take a salary, which he had a right on the basis of scriptural truth. But he gave up every one of them, legitimate rights which others claimed, and he encouraged them to, but not for himself, in order to fulfill his responsibility. Now please note, there is morally nothing wrong with any one of the three things he gave up. But it was essential in order for him to fulfill his objective. May I underscore a couple strategic observations for you from verse 24 that you need to weave into the fabric of your thinking? Things you need to understand as a Christian desiring to make an impact in your generation as you are. Number one, please note from this verse that the Christian life is similar in many respects to a race, but it is different in one respect because it is totally unique. You see, in a physical race, everyone runs, but only one can win. In the Christian race, everyone runs, and everyone can win. Not all of them do, but they can. And if they don't, it's because they choose to lose. Major point. You are not competing in this race against other Christians. I believe the greatest mark of carnality in the church today is our comparison. We spend all of our time comparing ourselves with someone else. God never does that. And it's sin for you to do it. And it will cripple your involvement in the race. We are not competing against others. We are competing against the opposition, the world, the flesh, the devil. Everything is cut loose by the enemy to defeat us in this race. The second thing I want you to note is, what is the prize? The prize is not salvation. It's service. The prize is not redemption. It's rewards. Paul has already said, "For by grace are ye saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it's the gift of God. Not of works, lest any man should boast." Ladies and gentlemen, salvation is a gift. The entrance fee costs you nothing because it costs Jesus Christ everything. But the maintenance fee may cost you everything. Not to become a Christian, but to win the race. There's a third truth I want you to see from verse 24. And that is, you need to develop a winner's theology. You know what bothers me? And this is what excites me about working with young people. I think, God willing, we're going to raise up a new generation of Christians who do not suffer from a loser's limp. There is a book you ought to read by A.W. Tozer entitled The Knowledge of the Holy. And in that book he makes a profound statement. Listen, because it could change the whole course of your life. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. And the most portentous fact about any man is not what he at a given time may say or do, but what he in his deep heart considers God to be like. You know, if I could only do one thing for you men and women, you know what it would be? I would fill your minds with a big God. Because the problem in the Christian community today is that our God
is too small.
And the size of your God determines the nature of the race and how you're going to participate in it. That's why Paul could say, I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. I run into people all the time and say, Brother Henry, I just can't do it. I said, well, Paul said you can. Do you think he's a liar? Oh, no. You just don't think he's telling the truth. And men and women, there are only two groups of people. There are those who can, and there are those who can't, and they're both right. And the difference, ultimately, is whether your confidence is in yourself or Christ. Man, if you go out of the Anatole in 1985 convinced you, personally, are going to take your campus by storm, you're going to pull this thing off, you are in for the greatest disillusionment of your life. But if you go out of here convinced, we can win, because we're on the winning side, we're related to the winner. As Paul says in Romans, we're more than conquerors through him that loved us. Our God is able to do exceeding abundantly above what you ask or even think, according to the power that works within us. See, Jesus Christ said, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. You know what that tells me? Two things. It tells me, number one, I'm going to have opposition. Count on it. Then when you get it, you won't be disappointed. But it also tells me that I am an overcomer, because I am associated with the one who has already told me what the outcome is. See, Paul is saying, you've got to run to win. I spent a lot of time with professional athletic teams, and I have never seen an exception. And a good coach will always bring it to the fore. Watch a team that's playing not to lose, and I will show you a team that will not win. This is what many Christians are doing. This is why we have a defensive posture. We are playing not to lose. Paul says, play to win. And that makes all the difference in the dynamic. You see, the key to 1985 is not what you are going to do for Jesus Christ, but what you allow Jesus Christ to do through you. In verse 25, the secret that is stated is illustrated. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last. We do it to get a crown that will last forever. Will you know two things? First of all, there is a comparison, and secondly, there is a contrast. Mark the comparison. They go into strict training. Now, we need to understand a little background at this point. The Isthmian Games is in Paul's mind. They were held every other year, second only to the Olympics. They were held very close to the city of Corinth, so the people were very familiar with the picture. Every competitor in the Isthmian Games had to undergo strict training that lasted for 10 months. It involved a strict diet, no wine, very regimented habit patterns, and in addition to that, close supervision by a judge who could disqualify you at any point and say, disqualified, and that's the end of the ball game for you. See, it's not just a matter of what are you going to do in the race. It's a matter of what are you going to do preparing for the race. And what Paul wants you to know is, if you're going to get in this race and you're going to run to win, then this is no half-hearted effort. This will involve some self-denial and often of many legitimate pleasures. That's why in Hebrews 12:1 he says, "Let us lay aside the things that hinder and the sin which so easily trips us up." See, the question is not, is it good or bad? The question is, does it hinder? Does it keep you from winning the race? Dallas Cowboys coach Tom Landry once remarked, "I have a job to do that is not very complicated, but it's often difficult. My task is to get a group of men to do what they don't want to do so they can achieve the one thing they have wanted all of their lives." That's why in Hebrews 12:1 he says, "Let us lay aside the things that hinder and the sin which so easily trips us up." See, the question is not, is it good or bad? The question is, does it hinder? Does it keep you from winning the race? Dallas Cowboys coach Tom Landry once remarked, "I have a job to do that is not very complicated, but it's often difficult. My task is to get a group of men to do what they don't want to do so they can achieve the one thing they have wanted all of their lives." What a statement of what discipleship is all about. Getting people to do what they don't want to do in order to accomplish the one thing they give everything in life for. That's total fulfillment. Deep satisfaction. Spending as much time with young people as I do, they're often asking me, "Well, Prof, if I've got to go into strict training, when's the best time to do that?" My friend, you've got the best time right now. It will never be better. In Lamentations chapter 3 and verse 27, there's a verse of scripture you ought to tack up on your bulletin board in your room at the college. This is what it says. "It's good for a person to bear the yoke when he is young." You know, the only advantage of age is that it gives you a little perspective to look back on. You know what I thank God for? I thank God for some college professors. I thank God for some people that He brought into my life that forced me to stop playing games. That faced me with the issue, "Hendricks, you're either going to have to fish or cut bait." You're either going to have to keep your mouth shut or put your life on the line. And it was a pretty high price tag. And I would say that all of my present ministry, humanly speaking, is the product of the strict training and discipline that I sustained when I was a young man. And I have young men and young women sitting across my desk almost every day of the week who look at me and say to me, "Prof, I'd give my right arm if I had your discipline." And I'm forced to ask, where did I get that? I'll tell you, the grace of God gave it to me, number one, through a pagan father who better prepared me for the ministry than most Christian dads I see today. I think of a professor who called me into his office one day and told me to sit down and keep my mouth shut, and every time I opened it, he let me know what the agreement was. And I went out of there, man, hotter than a hornet. And I rise up and call him blessed. He was the only man in 22 years of my life who had the spiritual guts to confront me with my greatest problem. that would have totally mortgaged my involvement in the race. Strict training. But look at the contrast. This is the thrust. That's what they did. They went into strict training. Why did they do it? Well, he says they did it to get a crown that will not last. You know what it was? It was a pine wreath. That's a biggie. You should see that baby 2 days later. Oh, you know, we say we've come a long way, man. We now give them, trophy. You ever been in somebody's home who had a whole room full of them and a couple drawers full of news clipping? Some of the most pitiful people I have ever met in my life. That's where they live. They live in the past, man. You should be here when I really did it. We may make them last a little more than 48 hours, but they're not worth that much more. And these people pour everything they've got into it. See, a lot of people see professional teams in terms of what happens on Sunday in a game. I have seen up close what happens during the week, and it's not fun and games. And those guys that played in the Rose Bowl and those guys that played in the Cotton Bowl and every other bowl, man, that's the glory part. It's the grind behind it. Why do they do it? They do it because we can say, we won. And I say, great. You know who won in 1943? No, and I don't care. Nothing worse than stale athletics. Well, why do you do it? By contrast, for a crown that will last. Theirs is a pine wreath, yours is a golden crown. They'll last a few days, yours will last forever. My friend, it's the difference between that which is permanent and that which is perishable. By the way, where are you going to invest your life? See, Paul wants you to know that it'll cost you like crazy to get in this race and become significant. But you need to understand that throughout the ages of eternity, you will not hear the applause of men, which is so fickle. I am closely associated, as you know, with a cowboy organization, and I never cease to be amazed that an organization that can go to the Super Bowl as many times, can go to the championship as many times, has got a group of people who will meet out in a stadium and boo the team. Because they didn't make it to the playoffs. But my friend, that's par for the human course. What a contrast to have God Almighty say, I love it. It delights my heart. And it will throughout all of the ages of eternity. The strenuous self-denial of the athlete in training for the fleeting reward, I think, is a rebuke to all half-hearted, flabby, anemic Christian servants that we see so much of today. But these men and women will pour their life for that which is perishing, and we give so little for that which is permanent. We look at the application in verses 26 and 27. Don't miss this. You miss everything. This is the clue to Paul's life commitment. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I don't fight like a man beating the air. No. I beat my body, and I make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself might not be disqualified for the prize. Please note, he states it negatively in verse 26 and positively in verse 27. And again, he uses two athletic analogies. Paul must have been drenched in the athletic spectacles of his time. He said, first of all, I run like a runner, not without aim. There is a concentration of effort. This individual knows the objective. He knows where he's going. He's got clear-cut purpose and direction. But please note, he says, I'm not like a boxer beating the air. Now, some people have thought erroneously that this was talking about shadow boxing. No, my friends, this is not a reference to shadow boxing. That's a necessary and legitimate exercise in the training of a boxer. He's talking about the actual contest. He's talking about an individual who may have received a blow to the head so that he's lost his control and his consciousness, and he's still hanging in there, swinging his arm, but nothing's happening. He's missing the mark. Going through the motion. Paul says, no, that's not like my life. I want every blow to count. I want the opponent reeling with the impact. Is that true in your generation? These students ask me all the time, you know, boy, they're beginning to give us a little gas down there at the campus, man. They're really giving us fit. Good. Thing that bothers me about most Christian organizations on most pagan campuses is that we're not that significant. Isn't it they nail us to the wall? They just ignore us. You see, in the early church, it was the pagans who stayed up at night trying to figure out how to control this thing. Today, it's the Christians who stay up at night saying, whoo, how are we going to do it? So we get the wrong people staying up. And the reason is, there's a lot of activity, but no accomplishment. Have you learned the barrenness of busyness? See, some of us become almost like Pavlov's dogs, don't we? The bell rings and we salivate. You know, and all of a sudden you, ooh, I smell a pagan. Hey, do you know that God has a wonderful plan for your life? Well, that's too convicting. Let's move on. Second, look at verse 27. Positively, look at the process. Try this one on for size. He says, I beat my body black and blue. It's the Greek word for maul. Or buffet, not buffet. This is the favorite verse of a number of my friends. Buffet your body. That's not what he's talking about here. He's saying, don't be bound by the bod. It's an instrument. Make sure it's a tool, not a trap. And again, he's not talking about things that are evil, but things that are good, but which may be the enemy of the better. And then he says, not only do I beat my body black and blue, I sacrifice, but I make it my slave. I discipline myself. See, a lot of us as Christians are like Niagara Falls without a hydroelectric plant. No means of harnessing the energy. Oh, I find young people who've got ability, they got more shots going for them than I ever thought of having. But no application. No discipline. Paul says you need to master your body, not to be mastered by it. Audubon, the great naturalist, was willing to go to prolonged discomfort to learn more of the world of birds. One of his biographers makes this statement. He counted his physical comforts as nothing compared with his success in his work. He would rise at midnight, night after night, go out into the swamps to study the habits of certain nighthawks. He would crouch motionless for hours in the dark and fog, feeling himself well rewarded if, after weeks of waiting, he secured one additional fact about a single bird. During one summer, he went day after day to the bayous near New Orleans to observe shy waterfowl. He would have to stand almost to his neck in the nearly stagnant water, scarcely breathing, while counting poisonous moccasin snakes who swam past his face, and great alligators passed and repassed his silent watch. It was not pleasant, he said. As his face glowed with enthusiasm. But what of that? I have the picture of a bird. Does it rebuke you that a man will do that for a bird? When some of us will not for the Lord. Paul says, if you're going to get in this, you need to know that the name of the game is discipline. Any Christian can win, but not without personal discipline. And mark the purpose. So that after I have preached to others, I myself will be disqualified for the prize. See, the word preached is not what you and I tend to think. We think of somebody who's in, quote-unquote, the professional ministry. That's not the word that's used here. It's used sometimes of that. But in this context, it's very obvious. What he's talking about is a herald. What did this herald do? This herald went throughout the land summoning the competitors to the Isthmian or Olympic Games. They had no newspaper. They had no television. And what he's saying is this, think of it. I spent all of my life going all over the ancient world, summoning people to the race. Get in the contest. Run to win. And then facing the fact that I myself could end up disqualified. Ladies and gentlemen, if that was a live option to the Apostle Paul, where do you come in? Where do I come in? Man, I break out in a cold sweat every time I come to this verse. I fear lest having spent all of my life ministering to college groups with Crusade and InterVarsity and the Navigators and you name it, I might have summoned others to the race and have been in it for 35 or 40 years only to end up disqualified. And greater men than I have done it. See, I've seen men and women who have had the most incredible ministry that God has ever given to a human being. I saw a man who was a pastor of a church. To this day, I cannot believe what he did until he preached his last sermon. And he sliced his throat and undercut 40 years of ministry by a message given in the flesh with bitterness. I think of my closest friend, whom many of you know if I gave you his name, whom God has used like very few individuals. And I sat in a bar trying to rescue him from three prostitutes, pleading with him, come back, don't go. He has summoned a lot of people to the race, but ended up disqualified. Well, you say, Prof, that's a hard word. Yeah, it is. You ready for this? See, I think most of us need to come out of our bubble of idealism into the world of reality. And may I remind you, there is nothing, nothing, nothing in your society that will contribute to your running the race. to win. Soft societies do not produce strong saints. And you are going to have to break with the herd. You are going to have to become a breed apart. You are going to have to make some tough decisions. One writer put it, "It is all too apparent that many young people, our leaders of tomorrow, have opted to anesthetize themselves against the pain of growing up and accepting responsibility." Ladies and gentlemen, what this passage is saying to you and to me is commit yourself to a cause, not merely a career. Commit yourself to a cause that you can give yourself to, something that will outlast you, something that is greater than you are, something that is worth investing everything you've got in. In the first part of the 20th century, a French peasant maid by the name of Joan of Arc was called upon to save her country from its enemies. And with her sacred sword, her consecrated banner, and her belief in her mission, she swept her enemies before her. She sent a thrill of enthusiasm through the French army, such as neither king nor statesman could produce. On one occasion, she said to one of her generals, "I'll lead the men over the wall." The general said, "Not a man will follow you." Joan replied, "I'll not look back to see if anyone is following me." But the soldiers of France did follow Joan, and she saved her country from the British and then fell into their hands. While the fires were being lighted around the stake at which this 19-year-old French peasant maid of Orleans was to be burned alive, she was given a chance to regain her liberty by denying what she believed. And in choosing fire over freedom, this is what she said. Listen. The world can use these words. I know this now. Every man gives his life for what he believes. Every woman gives her life for what she believes. Sometimes people believe in little or nothing, and yet they give their lives to that little or nothing. One life is all we have, and we live it, and then it's gone. But to surrender what you are and live without belief is more terrible than dying. Even more terrible than dying young. But there's a worse fate than living without belief. It is to live with a firm commitment to that which at the end of life, at the portals of eternity, turns out to have betrayed you. Men and women, when you come to the end of your life and have nothing but death to look forward to, and nothing but memories to look back on, what will you need to conclude that you won the race? Interesting sign in an office not too far removed from this hotel. I saw it one day when I was waiting for a Christian businessman. It says, "In 20 years, what will you wish you had done today?" And under it, in the largest print, "Do it now."